Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Oh, I got to read the chapter tonight. It's a bit different, and it's a longish chapter too. It's 6 pages long, so that'll get me back into the swing of things. Thank you so much, Simply Productive, for doing those readings. Simply Productive said, "I hope you know I was kidding, Ander. You are a great host, and I'm frankly amazed at how intelligible you are at 2 a.m. on a frequent basis." I knew you were joking. Yeah, I thought it was quite funny. Thanks for doing those readings. It was cool. And the next thing is that after that joke about feeling like you know me so well because you hear me every day, and that's how celebrities get stalkers. No, I feel like I know you guys too. Maybe I haven't heard, you know, everyone in the community's voice as much as you've heard mine. But I really look forward to hanging out with you guys every night. And I don't know, I always think, how cool would it be to have a meetup of all the people that have been involved with this? But of course, we all live all around the world, so that's not exactly possible. But we get to meet up here on the internet every night, so that's pretty cool. The question that I asked you guys about part 3, chapter 12, was the kiddie life versus the peasant life. What are the pros and cons of both? Simply Productive also said, "I love how in love he is. I want to be that in love with someone. That would be nice." Would it be nice, though? Because it seems to cloud his... I wouldn't say cloud his judgment, but he doesn't seem to be able to function properly under the influence of that lust. "I Am Norwegian says, I love how quickly Lemon threw away all his ambitions for the simple life after catching Kitty's eyes for just a moment." Yeah, he was all about that peasant life, and then he saw Kitty, and then he was like, "What was I thinking? Screw that. He wants to be a peasant." "I like to imagine that I'd enjoy the peasant life, the simple life, at least as it's been described in the past few chapters. The best of both worlds would be Levin's strategy of being born rich, so that either way you don't really have to worry about the necessities." That's the conversation, isn't it? Which one's better? I mean, none of us really live a peasant life nowadays, do we? Well, maybe some of us do. But, you know, I was working on this winery today, and I've been doing little bits of odd jobs there, and my friend's the chef, and, you know, it's kind of like, well, I'm waiting tables, and today I was standing in a field and directing traffic into a car park, but standing in a beautiful vineyard with mountains all around me looking, this is just the nicest place. And then, at the end of the day, I walked down to the winery and we, you know, had a few glasses of wine and some of the food from the kitchen. And then I went back to my mate's house and to her family's home. And so her parents, they live on a farm, and we had barbecue food, lamb and pork, spare ribs. And we're eating broad beans that we'd picked out of their garden. Just very idyllic. And I don't know, I'm not going to say peasant life, because, you know, these people have a beautiful life, and they're not poor, that's for sure. They've made a good living doing what they do. But it is a very old-fashioned kind of, you know, they've got their own farm, and they grow all their own vegetables, and they cook, and they farm on a daily basis. And that's their life. And meanwhile, the whole point of today was this winery festival where people come out to these wineries and, you know, they get all dressed up and it's all fancy and they have their expensive wines and overpriced meals, and they do this little winery tour. So they'll hop to two or three different wineries and enjoy the view and the music and all that. It's really nice. It's really nice. But to those people, it's like, you know, that most of the people that come along have come out from inner city to the mountains to enjoy, you know, a few hours of country life. And I don't know, I don't think any of them had a better day than what we had on the service side of that. You know, I mean, we had to work hard, sure, But at the end of the day, we took home one of those bottles of wine as well, you know, one of those $60 bottles. And we ate all the same food, and I don't know. So I kind of feel like today was a very good cross-section of peasant versus privileged life and being caught right in the middle of it. A lot to think about. Not really. I'm just waffling on. I did have a point to make out of all that. Oh, yeah, because we were saying, like, the people who live, you know, these kind of posh city folk that come out to the wineries for the weekend, they live in a city, and we were saying, well, what are they doing there? They just entertain themselves, don't they? They're always trying to amuse themselves by going to events. But meanwhile, we were just sitting on the back patio of my friend's farm, having some leftover wine and some fresh barbecue meats, and saying, like, how could that be better than this? You know, it was a beautiful spring evening, nice and warm day. And, yeah, like, it couldn't be better than that. There would be nowhere I'd rather be. Not a lot of comments today, says Simply Productive. So I'll go on for a bit. I want to say my guess will come true, and Kitty and Levin will end up together regardless. Hopefully, we shall see. I think it sounds like it'll be a situation where she realizes she wants a man who is practical, down to earth, and just generally nice and goes for it. And look, boom, there's Levin. Happy ending for all those who deserve one. Yeah, well, that would be cool. I wouldn't be opposed to that. Although, I'm not that sold on Kitty. Is Kitty that awesome? I don't know. I suppose I don't really have a clear picture of her. Now, who has been mailing me today? I just want to get a little cheer squad going here. Oh, Swim said the Mama Fishy sent me a mail today saying I'd be happy to take over some Hemingway list readings. But I have no idea how to go about it. So I've emailed back. I've replied and telling you how to go about it. But I just wanted a little cheer squad of people to encourage Swim said the Mama Fishy to do some reading. And anyone who else who wants to do some reading. I don't know why. It's, you know, partly because it's convenient for me, sure. I have to do less reading. I like being read to as well. It's a nice thing. But also, I don't know, I just kind of feel like I love the thought of all the names that I've been seeing over these months to get your voice on the podcast. That's really the main kick that I get out of it. That's why I really like this, to hear you guys' voices. So please, guys, don't be shy. Do some recordings for me. Anyway, I'm going to read you chapter 13. It's a longie. And it goes like this. None but those who knew Karenin most intimately knew that this apparently cold and sober-minded man had one weakness, quite inconsistent with the general trend of his character. Karenin could not, with equanimity, hear or see a child or a woman weeping. The sight of tears upset him and made him quite incapable of reasoning. The chief of his staff and his secretary knew this and warned women who came with petitions that they should on no account give way to tears if they did not want to spoil their case. He will get angry and won't listen to you, they said. And in such cases, the mental perturbation which tears produced in Karenin really found expression in hurried bursts of anger. I can do nothing for you. Kindly go away, he would shout on these occasions. When Anna, on their way home from the races, announced to him what her relations with Vronsky were and immediately hid her face in her hands and began crying, Karenin, despite his indignation with her, was, as usual, overcome by that mental perturbation. Being aware of this, and of the fact that any expression he could at that moment find for his feelings would be incompatible with the situation, he tried to conceal all signs of life within himself and neither moved nor looked at her. That was the cause of the strange death-like look on his face which had so struck Anna. When they reached home, he helped her out of the carriage and took leave of her with his usual curtsy, uttering non-committal words. He said he would let her know his decision next day. His wife's words, confirming as they did his worst suspicions, had given Karenin a cruel pain in his heart. This pain was rendered more acute by physical pity for her, evoked by her tears. But when alone in the carriage, to his surprise and joy, he felt completely relieved of that pity and of the suspicions and jealousy that had lately so tormented him. He felt like a man who has just had a tooth drawn, which has been hurting him for a long time. After terrible pain, a sensation as if something enormous, bigger than his whole head, were being pulled out of his jaw, he feels scarcely believing in his happiness that the thing which has so been poisoning his life and engrossing his attention no longer exists, and that it is possible again to live, think, and be interested in other things. What Karen had experienced was a feeling of this kind. It had been a strange and terrible pain, but it was past, and he felt he could live again and think of other things besides his wife. Without honour, without heart, without religion, a depraved woman, I know it and could see it all along, though I tried out of pity for her to deceive myself, thought he. And it really seemed to him that he had always seen it. He recalled all the details of their past life, and details which he had not previously considered wrong now proved to him clearly that she had always been depraved. I made a mistake when I bound up with my wife. I made a mistake when I bound up my life with hers, but in my mistake there was nothing blameworthy. Therefore I ought not to be unhappy. It is not I who am guilty, he said to himself, but it is she. She does not concern me. She does not exist for me. What would happen to her and to her son, toward whom his feelings had changed as they had toward her, no longer occupied his mind. The one thing that preoccupied him was the question of how he could best divest himself of the mud with which she in her fall had bespattered him, of how to do it in the way which would be most decent, most convenient for him, and consequently fairest, and how he should continue his active, honest, and useful career. I ought not to be unhappy because a despicable woman has committed a crime, but I must find the best way out of this painful situation in which she has placed me, and find it I will, said he to himself, frowning more and more. I'm not the first and shall not be the last, and without taking into account the historical instances of wives' unfaithfulness, beginning with Menelaus and La Belle Helena, whose memory had just recently been fresh in everybody's mind, quite a number of cases of infidelity, the infidelity of modern wives, occurred to Karenin. The footnote says La Belle Helena was a comic opera by Offenbach, just then in vogue in Moscow and Petersburg. Must have been an opera about infidelity. Daryalov, Poltovsky, Prince Karabinov, Count Paskudin, Dram, yes, even Dram, that honest businesslike fellow, Semenov, Shagin, Sigonin, he passed them in review. It's true, a kind of unreasonable ridicule falls on these men, but I never could see it in any other light than as a misfortune, and felt nothing but sympathy. Karenin reflected, though it was not true, he had never felt any sympathy of the kind, and the more cases he had come across of husbands being betrayed by their wives, the better the opinion he had of himself. It is a misfortune that may befall anyone, and it has befallen me. The only question is how best to face the situation, and he began mentally reviewing the courses pursued by other men in similar positions. Daryalov fought a duel. In his youth, Karenin had been particularly attracted by the idea of dueling, just because he was physically a timid man and was quite aware of it. He could not think without horror of a pistol being levelled at him, and had never used any kind of weapon. This horror had in youth often induced him to take mental measures of his strength in case he should ever be confronted by a situation in which it would be necessary to face danger. Since, however, he had achieved success and gained a firm position in the world, he had long forgotten that feeling, but the old habit now revived and claimed its own, and the fear of being a coward was again so strong that he considered this point a long time and flattered his vanity with the idea of a duel, though he knew beforehand that he would on no account fight one. Of course, our society is still so uncivilized, not as in England, that very many among the many, were those whose opinion Karenin particularly valued, would regard a duel as the right thing to do. But what object would be gained, supposing I challenged him, continued Karenin, and vividly picturing to himself the night he would spend after the challenge, and the sensation of having a pistol pointed at him, he shuddered and realized that he would never do it. Supposing, he went on, they showed me how to do it, placed me, and I pulled the trigger, he closed his eyes, and it turned out that I had killed him, and he shook his head to drive away that stupid thought. What sense is there in killing a man in order to define one's relations with a guilty wife and a son? Nevertheless, I shall have to decide what to do with her. But what is even more likely and sure to happen is that I should be killed or wounded, then I, an innocent man, should be the victim. That would be still more senseless, and this is not all. A challenge from me would not be an honest action. Do I not know beforehand that my friends would never allow me to go so far as to fight a duel, would not allow a statesman whom Russia needs to expose himself to danger? What then would happen? This would happen. I, knowing beforehand that matters would never be allowed to reach a dangerous point, should have challenged a man in order to cover myself with false glamour. That would be dishonest, it would be false, it would be a deceiving myself as well as others. No, a duel is unthinkable, and no one expects it of me. My aim is to safeguard my reputation, which I need for the uninterrupted pursuit of my career. His official pursuits, which had always appeared essential to Karenin, now assumed an even greater importance. Having considered and rejected the idea of a duel, Karenin turned his thoughts to divorce, the next expedient of which some of the wronged husbands, he remembered, had availed themselves. Going over all the cases of divorce he knew, there were very many, and in the highest society with which he was well acquainted, Karenin could not recall one in which the purpose of the divorce was the one he had in view. In all these cases, the husband had ceded or sold the unfaithful wife, and the very person who, according to law, had no right to remarry entered into fictitious pseudo-legal relations with a pretend husband. Karenin saw that in his own case, it would be impossible to obtain a legal divorce, that is, a divorce in which the guilty wife would be simply cast off. He knew that in their complex conditions of life, it would not be possible to obtain those coarse proofs of a wife's infidelity which the law demanded. He knew that in that life there was a certain convention of refinement which would not allow him to bring forward such proofs had they existed, because such an action would make him sink even lower than she in public opinion. Footnote says, according to Russian law, the guilty party in a divorce could not remarry, and to obtain a divorce, ocular evidence of adultery was required. To attempt a divorce could only lead to a lawsuit and a scandal which would give his enemies great opportunity for calumny, and would lower his high position in society. The chief object of his life, the settling of conditions with the least possible amount of disturbance, could not be furthered by divorce. Besides, it was evident that as a consequence of divorce, the wife would break off relations with her husband and unite with her lover. In Karenin's soul, however, despite the complete and contemptuous indifference he felt for his wife, there was one feeling left with regard to her, an objection to her being in a position to unite unhindered with Vronsky. So, making her crime advantageous to her. The very thought of it irritated him so, to such an extent, that he groaned within a pain, rose and changed his place in the carriage, and for a long while after that he sat wrapping his fluffy rug around his bony, easily chilled legs. Besides a formal divorce, it would be possible to act as Karabinov, Paskudin, and that good-natured dram did, and just separate, he resumed when he had grown calm again. But this measure would have all the inconvenience of a divorce scandal and would throw his wife into Vronsky's arms just in the same way. No, it is impossible, impossible, he said aloud, again wrapping the rug around his legs. I cannot be unhappy, but she and he must not be happy. The jealousy that had tormented him during the period of uncertainty had left him when his wife's words had, with great pain, drawn that aching tooth. But another feeling had now taken the place of the jealousy. It was a wish that his wife's guilt should meet with retribution. He did not acknowledge to it to himself, but in the depths of his soul he wished her to suffer for impairing his peace of mind and his honour. And having reviewed the possibilities of a duel, of divorce, and of separation, and having again rejected them, Karenin came to the conclusion that there was only one course to be followed: to keep her with him, hiding from the world what had happened, and taking all necessary steps to put a stop to her love affair, and above all, though he did not confess this to himself, to punish her. I must inform her of my decision, that after considering the painful situation in which she has placed her family, I think that an external status quo would be better for both parties than any other expedient, and that I am prepared to keep to that on the strict understanding on her part that she will obey my will and break off relations with her lover. In confirmation of this decision, after it had already been reached, another powerful argument occurred to Karenin. It is only by this course that I can conform with religion, he said to himself. It is only the only way that makes it possible for me not to disown my guilty wife and to give her a chance of repenting, and even painful as it will be, to devote part of my powers to her redemption. Though Karenin knew that he could have no moral influence on his wife, that all his attempts to redeem her would lead to nothing but lies, and although during the painful moments he had lived through he had not once thought of seeking guidance in religion, now that his decision was, as he imagined, in conformity with religion, its sanction afforded him great satisfaction and even some comfort. It was pleasant to think that no one would have a right to say that in such an important crisis in his life he had not acted in accordance with that religion whose banner he had always held aloft amid general coldness and indifference. Proceeding to consider further details, Karenin could not even see why his relations with his wife should not remain almost the same as before. He could, of course, never again revive his respect for her, but there was no occasion for him to spoil his own life and to suffer just because she had proved a bad and unfaithful wife. Yes, time goes on, and time, which curses everything, will restore the old conditions, said Karenin to himself. That is it. It will restore them in so far that I shall not have this worry during the rest of my life. She must be unhappy, but I am not guilty, and therefore I cannot suffer. All right, there we go. Another chapter done. Whew. I feel like I haven't read for ages. That was fun. Have your say about that chapter over on the subreddit. Thanks for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.